This is a download from Newstalk 106 to 108. To download other programs or for more information, go online to newstalk.ie. Talking History with Patrick Gagan and Lindsay Erna Byrne on Newstalk 106 to 108.
In tonight's show, we're looking at the life and legacy of Charles Darwin, the man who challenged scientific orthodoxy and made the theory of evolution culturally acceptable. Well, in most parts of the world anyway. Mike Huckabee, who won the Republican primary in Iowa last week, is on the record as saying he doesn't believe in Darwin's theories. But is such a position defensible? Well, we're going to try and look at all the sides tonight. Now, the best Christmas present I got was from my sister and her husband. It was a box set of the TV show Heroes. And one man who was praised throughout that show is the subject of tonight's debate. Charles Darwin was born in England in 1809. He studied medicine in Edinburgh and theology at Cambridge before deciding to become a naturalist. For 5 years, he served on the HMS Beagle, travelling all around the world on a scientific expedition. And on this journey, he became convinced that modern species had evolved from a few earlier ones. Returning to England in 1836, he spent the rest of his life studying specimens, doing experiments, and writing about his findings. On the Origin of Species by Means of Natural Selection, usually known as The Origin of Species, was published in 1859 and it became his most famous work. In it, he explains his theory that evolution occurred through a process of natural selection, what he called in his fifth edition, Survival of the Fittest, though the term was not his. The Descent of Man, published in 1871, developed this theory and suggested that human beings, like other animals, were also the result of evolution, in our case from monkeys. Darwin's theories were controversial at the time, and they remain controversial. They are seen as challenging biblical accounts about the creation of the world, and the theories are not universally accepted. So how should we view Darwin in the 21st century? What made him the heroic thinker who changed how we view the world? And what was Darwin's legacy? To help me address these questions, I'm delighted to welcome our panel of experts. Cyril Aidan is the author of Charles Darwin, The Naturalist Who Started a Scientific Revolution, published by Carl and Graff. His most recent book is The Story of Man, also published by Carl and Graff, a book which asks, have we really changed, or are we just Stone Age people living in a space age world we have made but cannot control? Father Brendan Purcell is a lecturer in the Department of Philosophy at University College Dublin. He was a guest on our show on the Bible just before Christmas and was so good that we made him come back. Dr. John Van Wy is an historian of science at the University of Cambridge and is the founder and director of Darwin Online. And if you just Google Darwin Online, you'll find his site. It really is an incredible resource with a timeline, images, as well as online manuscripts and published materials. And last but by no means least, David Croke is Professor of Biochemistry at the Royal College of Surgeons. His major research interest is on the genetics of inherited disease in the Irish population. You are all very welcome. Now, John, if I could start with you. Evolution wasn't a new idea when Darwin was born, was it? His grandfather, Erasmus Darwin, had written about it.
Yes, that's true, but we tend to use the word evolution as if it meant only one thing. But in fact, before Darwin's time, people meant different things by it. So people had thought that living things might change. Okay, that idea wasn't new. But what Darwin introduced that was new was a single branching tree, that all of life was related genealogically.
And what was it that led him to develop these? Like, what was it like for him growing up? His mother died when he was very young. What was it in his childhood that made him want to study these things?
Well, I think it was always Darwin's natural taste that he loved nature and natural things. He loved collecting things. He loved collecting beetles. And by the time he was in his teens, it was pretty obvious that he was going to be a naturalist. Now, whatever his profession might have been, that would have been at the least his hobby. And it turned out with the Beagle Voyage that he devoted his entire life to science.
And Cyril, can I bring you in? Because I mentioned that he studied theology at Cambridge. He also studied medicine at Edinburgh. But none of these really seemed to suit him, did they?
No, both of them were his father's idea. His father was a very successful doctor and a rich man. But he was very concerned his son would not become an idle sporting man, in his own words. And he persuaded himself that the young Darwin at 16 would make a good doctor. And he sent him to Edinburgh for 2 years. Darwin did nothing at all. And it wasn't until Darwin's sisters broke the news to his father that Darwin wasn't interested in being a doctor. He had to think of another idea. So then he thought, what do you do with a young man who's only interested in beetles and shooting and hunting? It's not much use for any other career. He thought the obvious solution is the church. The country was full of fox-hunting parsons and beetle-collecting curates at the time, and he could afford to buy his son a living. So he sent him off to Cambridge, because if you wanted to be a clergyman in those days, you had to have a degree, not necessarily in theology, there wasn't such a degree, but you had to have a degree from Oxford or Cambridge. And Darwin couldn't really see any objection to, he thought it sounded like a reasonable idea. And so off he went. And right up to the day that the letter arrived inviting him to go on the Beagle voyage, he still thought that was his fate. It was just the most incredible coincidence that virtually the day that he was going to have to discuss with his father his career in the church after he graduated, he got this invitation.
So
and the rest is history, as they say.
So in a way, the Beagle was an escape hatch for him.
It was, and his father was very upset at this because he thought this is yet another way he's going to escape a proper job. And his immediate reaction was, this is nonsense. Go on a ship. You have to remember what the Navy was like in those days. For a rich gentleman's son to go on, you know, around the world voyage, as it turned out to be, among a lot of sailors, really was not a very good idea in his view. And it was only because Darwin's uncle, the second Josiah Wedgwood, persuaded Darwin's father that it was a reasonable thing for him to do, that he got the chance of going.
And David, can I ask you about this voyage of the Beagle? What was it aiming to do, and why was he so interested in taking part in it?
The voyage of the Beagle really was part of a larger program of mapping activities that the Admiralty were carrying out over a period of decades, if not centuries. Cook's voyage predated it and covered some of the same territory. So as part of the expedition team, not only were there cartographers and surveyors, but also it was normal to carry naturalists who would document all the flora and fauna that they observed as they travelled.
And it was a five-year mission, and that seems to have formed the basis then of all his future writings.
It certainly served, I think, to set him up as a serious professional naturalist, because, of course, as he collected during the voyage, specimens were sent back to England for analysis. And in the aftermath of the voyage, when he published his own journal of researches, there followed a whole series of volumes co-authored with some of the scientific luminaries of the day, like Richard Owen, who was a comparative anatomist, which essentially documented everything that he found. But there was one other aspect to carrying a naturalist. It was normal in those days for there to be quite a distinction between the captain and the officers on the one hand and the sailors on the other. And it was felt important for the captain to have a gentleman companion with whom he could engage in polite conversation. And Darwin certainly was vetted well and comprehensively in advance of the offer of the trip.
And the captain seems to have been quite an interesting character. He later committed suicide, and he was a nephew of Lord Castlereagh, the man who crushed the 1798 rebellion in Ireland, brought in the Act of Union, and who also committed suicide.
Yes. Certainly, they seem to have had quite a turbulent relationship during their years on the Beagle. Following the return to England, certainly they seem to have maintained reasonably good relations until the publication of The Origin. And at that point, their paths diverged. In fact, it's recorded that at the infamous or perhaps famous British Association debate in Oxford in 1860, where the pros and cons of The Origin were discussed, that he was seen clutching his Bible in frustration in the audience.
We're getting a lot of texts in already about evolution. Pat Burke says, Darwin got it all wrong. Everyone knows the world was created in 6 days. Ask Mike Huckabee. Someone else who didn't give their name texted in on 53106 to said, we got our panel wrong. We should have had one of those loopy fundamentalists who believe life started 6,000 years ago. Well, someone who's definitely not a loopy fundamentalist is Father Brendan Purcell. Now, Brendan, do we know anything about Darwin's religious beliefs at this point? He later became an atheist. But before he went on the Beagle tour, he was training to be a clergyman. So do we know what he was thinking when he was on this journey?
Well, I'm not going to disagree with you as the august chairman of this discussion, Patrick, but he didn't become an atheist. It's a little bit more complicated. Victorian gentlemen, there are very few atheists around, and Darwin, I think, avoided that particular strait. He was in between something and something else, I'd say. I think it's a very interesting question because, yes, he did. I always remember it was a kind-hearted coronet where Alec Guinness or someone was doing them. There's like six children. The fool of the family always goes into the church, you know, so I don't know whether that was an element of that there. But I mean, the point was that Darwin, it seems to me, despite having free thinkers in the family, I think, I mean, again, I know some of the other people know much more about than I think Erasmus, some of these people were pretty free thinking. He seems to have had a rather literal view of the Bible himself, like rather low churchy view, if you like, which is surprising given that there were, as far as I know, in the family tree, these other folk. And it seems to me then that, like, and I have a comment written down here because I've always struck, and he mentioned, he read a guy called William Paley, who, you know, someone who later on spent his time disagreeing with, because Paley felt if you looked at things, you know, the famous example of he's going along the beach and he sees a watch or he sees a stone. The stone doesn't make him ask any question, but the watch must have been designed, and therefore, he goes on then, when I look at wonderfully organized biological things, they must have been designed by God. Therefore, God exists as soon as I see something. God caused everything. Now, as a believer, I have no problem saying God caused everything, but excuse me, he certainly needs to do a ton of biology as well, and thanks be to goodness for Darwin and evolution. But the point is that at that stage, he was, to me, a kind of, if you like, if I can use that phrase, low church angle, rather literal-minded reader of the Bible, and it was a shock to him. Now, I'm not saying this because I'm sure there are members of the Church of England, other non-Catholic people, but like a Catholic would have believed, or anyone accepted Augustine, his commentary on the Genesis, for example, the six levels of interpretation, only one of them is literal. It's not necessarily even the most important way of reading the Bible. So Darwin happened, unfortunately, suffered from a kind of spiritual concussion. The early religious formation to me was incredibly narrow. And therefore, when you get later on a lot of, as it were, disagreements, and Paley had to throw out the window, and I think he was a brilliant observer. The facts led him to see that I don't need God to explain a bivalve or whatever, various things he saw on the trip and so on. So he had to move out of that, and he was dead right to move out of that. But some of the later religious problems he had, I think, were possibly due to the fact that he started on a kind of, if I could say that, a Huckabeest level, you know.
Okay, well, tonight we're debating the life and legacy of Charles Darwin. Keep your texts coming in, 53106. After the break, we're going to be talking about the voyage of the Beagle. We're going to be talking about what he found on the Galapagos Islands and elsewhere. So stay with us on News Talk. Now, John, can I bring you in about this voyage then? Because is it true that when he reached the Galapagos Islands that he saw things that made him develop his theories?
That's very widely believed, but no, it's not actually true. And that's something that really needs to be corrected. It's very widely believed that Darwin went to the Galapagos Islands and he saw the beaks of these finches in particular, and had a eureka moment where he said, aha, evolution must be the case. And it's absolutely not true. People believe that for many years. But in fact, he saw many things that made him wonder, but he had no idea how to explain them while he was actually there. It was only after he came back home to England that he laid out all of his specimens before him, and many of them he didn't know what they were. So, for example, the Galapagos species, many of them he had no idea whether they were species or just varieties. Experts in London had to tell him what they were. Only when he had that information, together with all of his experience from the 5 years voyage around the world, was he able to put these things together. And he used to list the things that made the difference to him, that made him come up with evolution. And he always gave a list of about three things. He would say, he observed that how species gradually change as he moves southwards down the continent of South America. So that is a geographical distribution of species. One would stop, and a very similar one would then have a range right next to it. The other thing was the fossils that he uncovered. The relationship between those fossils and the unique creatures that live in South America today was unmistakable. Things like sloths and armadillos that only live there. And he was finding these gigantic fossil ones. What was the relationship between the two? Why did they occur there? Well, he didn't hit on the idea then, but it was very curious. And the third thing that he used to list was the Galapagos Islands. He couldn't understand why was the relationship between the species on these volcanic recent islands in the Pacific Ocean. They were so similar to things that he had seen in South America, but they were all different. And these three kinds of things led him to the theory of evolution back home.
And when you said there that he didn't have, you know, he sometimes didn't know what the things were, that they weren't properly labelled. Was that his fault? Some people have said that he himself was careless when it came to the labelling.
He was very careful throughout the voyage. He kept amazing records. He had we have mountains of manuscripts that he left behind, notebooks that he carried in his pocket, and then he wrote up formal lists of his different kinds of specimens, geological, zoological, etc., on the ship, and he regularly shipped home boxes of specimens. However, there are some things that he collected on the Galapagos where he didn't record which island he got them on. And it didn't occur to him at the time that he would need to. He just figured a Galapagos bird was a Galapagos bird. and he thought that was good enough. And I suppose in South America that had been good enough. When you're in Patagonia and you find a woodpecker, he can write down Patagonian woodpecker, and that was good enough. So, you know, those are both true. Yes, he didn't label them correctly, and that caused him some difficulties later on.
Okay, and David, in his autobiography, he talked about how that this was the formative event in his life. He said, it determined my whole career. What was it really about, you know, finding all of these things that, that you think helped him to make these leaps then?
I think there are several factors. One, of course, is the amazing richness of the specimens that he collected. But one other aspect, which is only really coming out now in the work of some of our contributors here this evening, is the aspect of Darwin as geologist. And he was certainly earlier in his career probably a better geologist than he was a naturalist. And following on from the work of Charles Lyell, who came up with the idea that that essentially we could explain geological change by the application of the normal processes that we see around us, like erosion, over long, long periods of time, that led him to a view that perhaps the normal processes of change in the natural world acting over long periods of time could equally affect large-scale changes in animals and plants. So I think not only did he find the evidence in terms of geology, botany, zoology and so on, but I think also it led to enormous changes in his way of viewing the natural world.
And Cyril, I'm just looking at the Darwin Online website, and you know, in the biographical sketch, it talks about his the profound reactions that he caused in geology, zoology, taxonomy, botany, paleontology, philosophy, anthropology, psychology, literature, and theology. Like, how did one man get to challenge in so many different areas?
Well, firstly, he was a rich man, so he never had to work for a living. He only ever did all his life what he wanted to do. But secondly, he was the world's greatest networker. He had we have 15,000 letters that he wrote himself to various people, picking their brains, and lots of letters they wrote back. To give you an example, his servant on the Beagle afterwards went to live in Australia. And Darwin was writing a book about fossils, and so he wanted to know something about barnacles in Australia. And so he, without any more ado, he wrote to his former servant in Australia, and I don't think he knew whether he lived a mile from the beach or 1,000 miles from the beach, and he said, I'd be very grateful if you could possibly sort of go down to the beach and get me a specimen of X, Y, and Z. And coming from this rich man's background, it never occurred to Darwin that he was saying anything unreasonable. He would always have said, well, he could always say no. And of course, in due course, the barnacles came back from Australia, and this happened with people all over the world. There was this network of people, some of them ordinary people who are just collecting because he asked them to, some of them who are the world's leading experts on the subject. And it was this networking. And then one other thing, he had perhaps almost more than any other scientist we know, an ability to make connections. Other people would look at what seemed quite unconnected phenomena. Darwin had this genius for putting two and two together and getting five. And it was partly because he wasn't an academic. Darwin always believed that knowledge was knowledge, whether it's academic knowledge or any other kind of knowledge. And so, for instance, if he went to a meeting in London and came back, he would sometimes stand, midnight, 1 o'clock in the morning, chatting to his coachman about the breeding of horses. He used to go to pubs in London where working men used to meet pigeon fanciers and join two pigeon fancy clubs that met in pubs because he wanted to know about the breeding of pigeons. And it was this combination of academic knowledge and practical knowledge and enormous networking that combined with his own ability to put two and two together put him in a league of his own when it came to, reaching conclusions and forming theories.
Well, Cyril, you call him a rich man and a genius. One of our texters says, is Fitzroy not the real hero? That's the captain of the Beagle. Darwin was a spoilt brat and really only a collector. He just reiterated what was already suspected.
No, he most certainly didn't. I mean, you only have to read what people, very great scientists, people like Lyell, people like Huxley, who was known as Darwin's bulldog, if you read what their opinion was of Darwin and what their opinion of what he contributed, to say the fact that he was rich was his good fortune. I said in my book, he's one of the luckiest men who ever lived. But, you know, if any man put his luck to good use, it was Darwin.
Brendan, Paul in Galway is enjoying the show, and he thinks that you must be an uncle of Dave Fanning's because you talk as fast as him.
But just to come back to what Cyril was saying, because I think it really is something, from the viewpoint of philosophy, there's something special about Darwin. I think there is a reason why he did put the connections that, like, say, from our viewpoint, we'd look at different kinds of questions. Like, say, a structural question would be, what is the nature of something or other, let's say an atom, and so on. And maybe you'd have a statistical question, how often does a subatomic particle? There are different kinds of questions. But Darwin asked another question. I'm not saying it's the only one, but he really did it well, which is a developmental question, is how does X become Y? It's a very different kind of question to what's X. Some people complain that if you read The Origin of Species, there's nothing about species at all. In a sense, it's about how one X changes into a Y. But that kind of question, it's like in maths, the thing of an operator, how one thing causes one function to change into another. And that style of questioning, which is a developmental style, Darwin, you began your program by mentioning that cultural thing, but I would say it's a huge breakthrough in the philosophy of science.
But why was it so controversial?
Well, that was a whole lot of other things. I would say a lot of the controversy wasn't of Darwin's making, or maybe some of it was, but effectively there wasn't much of a controversy on the continent of Europe. You know, there was a particular English controversy, which came back to the meeting you were talking about earlier on, at the very beginning you mentioned, David, which was the kind of row, religious row, and so on and so forth. I actually think when I look at it, you're almost trying to say, where's the beef now? What was the problem? And if there was a problem on Darwin's side, I'm very reluctant to say it, because I really do think he was, it deserves the praise he's getting. It was that he didn't have the intellectual tools, let's say philosophical or theological, to say there are different kinds of questions that arise in the natural sciences to the ones that arise in philosophy and theology. They don't get in each other's way. There's a guy called Gillespie, he's a really fine book on Darwin's kind of religion. And he says, you know, it's amazing how often you can't kind of wash it out. There's an enormous amount of stuff in the Origin to keep out the notion of special creation. Because he felt that if I allow God to be creating different things, I'm being told by a certain type of person, I don't need to do biology. Now that was a mistake in part. He shouldn't have had to think that. And I'd say if he'd been born in Germany, France, or Italy, he wouldn't have even thought about it. He would have got on with the work. And there are other kinds of questions that come up, which are, if you like, questions about origins, existence, and everything else. They're not questions in biology at all. So I think the culture he was in didn't prepare him that well for that type of question. He did his best not to foment it. But some of the people like Darwin's bull, and I often have a lot more sympathy for Darwin in a sense than some of these pains in the neck people who are kind of breathing down his neck. And I'm more or less saying you don't have to do biology, it's all in the Bible. And of course, I call that the fallacy of answering the question you haven't asked. Because Genesis isn't asking questions about, you mentioned, for example, David Lyell, questions like that. It's not asking questions about geology or when God had his, you know, or when he had a cup of tea and decided, now let's create the world. It's not asking that kind of question. So it's asking other more important questions to my mind, like morality, about the origin of everything. But so they were forcing, some of these narrow-minded readers were forcing the Bible to answer questions it never asked. And to an extent, not Darwin, I would say, but some of his more, if you like, followers who maybe lost the run of things a bit, were making biology answer questions that biology doesn't deal with. And I think that's where a lot of the rows come from.
John, can I put a text to you from one of our listeners, A, in Dublin? He's enjoying the show. Great show, guys. He wants to know, what about Wallace, Alfred Wallace? Didn't he do the work but hadn't the courage to publish? What about that?
Well, it's a very famous story, Darwin and Wallace, but the sad fact is that Wallace simply was 20 years too late. Darwin did come up with his theory of evolution by natural selection in the late 1830s, and Wallace came up with his in the late 1850s, and he sent a letter to Darwin which included an essay that he had written up, which he thought, I know you're working on something like this. If you find this interesting, would you pass it on to Charles Lyell? Well, Darwin opened it and was shocked to see that it was strikingly similar to his own theory. And his friends then decided to publish papers by both men jointly to avoid any question of a fight over priority. And the two men became good friends, and they never were jealous of each other. And Wallace always very generously gave as much of the credit as possible to Darwin. In fact, one of his great books after Darwin's death, he called simply Darwinism. He called the theory Darwinism and wouldn't take credit for himself, because not just because Darwin was first, that's really quite trivial, but because Darwin did all the work to demonstrate that it was true. And what is what really counts, he convinced the international scientific community that he was right.
And I'm getting a few texts in about Master and Commander. Was Wallace in that, or are any of these people?
No, but that is a great film, and it's obvious when you watch it that they've got Darwin in mind, because they visit the Galapagos Islands, and the ship's naturalist is collecting specimens, but he has to drop them because they have to go off and fight the French. And it's you're left to assume that if only, this is before Darwin, if only he could have collected these specimens, he would have discovered evolution. So the filmmakers are implying that any naturalist who could have gone to the Galapagos would have found evolution. It's, again, it's this old myth that that's where he got it from.
Very good. Now, David, I'm going to put a couple of texts to you, and they're contradictory texts. Brendan Maher says, the Bible is full of contradictions, fallacies and falsehoods. Darwin is proven facts. The Bible has none. But then Sean Francis Patrick O'Sullivan is kind of challenging that. He says, people speak as though the theory of evolution has been proved. Will someone please prove it for us this evening? So is the theory of evolution, has it been proven?
Personally, I would say absolutely, beyond any shadow of a doubt. I think one thing we need to address first is the question of what we mean by a theory. In everyday speech, we say, I have a theory about something, and it means speculation. But in science, a theory is a body of facts and hypotheses that build together to form a model which describes something in the natural world. For example, people are able to hear us this evening on radio because of the theory of electromagnetism. NASA are able to put satellites in orbit because of the theory of gravity. We understand the way in which the Earth is formed through the theory of plate tectonics. So a theory is much more than just a wild idea. We now have a vast amount of incontrovertible evidence which supports the belief that evolution is a fact. We have all of the indirect lines of evidence that Darwin had. We have the fossil record. We now have much more in the way of fossils than he had. We have an even greater description of the classification of living species. So we see that there are groups within groups, and that the natural world is really part of what John already referred to, a single branching tree of life. But we have something that Darwin would absolutely have loved. We have DNA. Almost all the living creatures on the planet share DNA as their genetic material. And in a real sense, we carry the fossils of our own origin and the traces of that unified tree of life within us. But we can also not just prove evolution indirectly, we can observe it happening. Look at the evolution of resistance to antibiotics in bacteria. Look at the evolution of HIV viruses as they infect a single human being with HIV/AIDS. We can see it in the plant world. In fact, the production of new plant species in horticulture relies upon hybridization, which is one of the processes by which new species are formed. So we have a vast body of evidence, and really evolution is now at the basis and part of the furniture in modern biology, modern medicine. And Theodosius Dobzhansky was a Russian-American experimenter in the 1940s, said that nothing in biology can be understood except in the light of evolution. I think nowadays that is even more true than it was in the 1940s.
And Cyril, can I ask you then about The Origin of Species, when that was published in 1859, and then The Descent of Man, I think 1871. How controversial were they at the time?
What you must understand is that there's a difference between the impact on younger scientists at the time of Darwin's book and the idea of evolution, and the his success, or rather lack of success, in persuading them of the reality of the mechanism that he described, which is called natural selection. One of the striking things about The Origin of Species is the speed with which, after it was published, certainly all the younger scientists of the day accepted that evolution was virtually a proven fact. He settled that argument virtually once and for all. There were religious people who couldn't take it because of the possible implications for human origins, which they didn't like.
And Cyril, what is natural selection? Is that survival of the fittest?
It's a phrase that Darwin afterwards regretted he'd used. It was Herbert Spencer's. Natural selection is what happens when you have a changing environment, say climate change, or you have any kind of change in the environment. And if you have got members of a species, creatures which are not equally endowed, for instance, let's make a very simple example. If we say that the world gets colder, And if there are some creatures who are carrying a gene for thicker fur, then what you will find over the generations is that those that convey to their offspring thicker fur, they will tend to have offspring that survive. This interplay between the different genetic endowment of individual members of a species and changes in the environment, this interplay, what Darwin said, it was like 100,000 wedges working away, directing life in particular directions. That's natural selection. And what happened was that virtually no one would accept, even his great disciple Huxley, could bring himself to accept this mechanism of natural selection, because Darwin was not able, he didn't know anything about genetics, he didn't know anything about DNA, and he was unable to explain how natural selection actually worked at the cellular level. What happened, in 1922, 40 years after he died, it was possible for someone called John Cunningham, addressing the British Association of the Advancement of Science, to use the words, natural selection is as dead as the dodo. 40 years after he died, it wasn't until the 1930s that we started to get what we call the new synthesis, which was able to establish that Darwin had been right all along on the actual mechanism by which evolution occurred.
And Brendan, can I ask you about Darwin's own health? Because his health was so bad throughout his life, and especially in the early years. And he married a cousin, and then a number of his children were very unwell, including the son that he named after himself. And some people have speculated that that also influenced his theories, and that's why he was so interested in how breeding occurred and what happened.
Yeah, I think certainly the breeding thing was a question. I think, did he have 10 children? I think two of them died youngish enough, or quite young, was it 10? Quite a lot by even Victorian families. But I think he had appalling health, and he suffered. It's very hard to know sometimes whether it wasn't psychological, and that's not to pull him down a peg or two. He might have been mildly depressive or certainly hypochondriac, and maybe medicine wasn't able to deal with it and so on. But if I could come back even to the earlier question someone asked in about the science and has it been proven, I think it's also good to see that Darwin's own theory, it's quite a healthy situation. Sometimes you get the impression it's as rigid that you can't do anything to it. Someone mentioned, I think it was Cyril mentioned, the kind of neo-Darwinian synthesis in the 1930s with Fisher and those, where they brought in genetics in and gave it a kind of legs on it that it hadn't had in the early years of the 20th century, when people did say it was dead as a doornail. But there have been lots of developments since. And I mean, people know, for example, of punctuated equilibrium was just a word. But people have found that the standard Darwinian thing wasn't maybe, and not everyone maybe agree with me on this program, wasn't maybe rich enough to handle that. There was also a fact of stasis. There's also a fact that species take an awful long time to go. And they often, sometimes in the fossil record, you find that there's a sudden change. That came out with, Stephen Jay Gould and Niels Eldridge in the 1970s. And they ran into a lot of trouble from, if you like, very orthodox Darwinians who couldn't seem to take that every scientific theory takes questions on the chin and so on and so forth. And then that's been developed enormously in the 1990s with Evo Devo, where there's a discovery that the same body plan right across the file. Again, David, here's the expert in this, but there's about 35 basic animal groups, or 36. 35 of them have the same body plan from the very beginning, say around 500 million years ago, and there's no change in that body plan right up to now. So effectively, that's the genetic, the DNA. It's even more complicated than just DNA. The body plans of all the animals are the same. So that's a kind of a huge shift to the theory, where you've got Darwin handling change, but the kind of genetic stuff is also handling stability. And that's been, Stephen Jay Gould tried to bring the two of them together. There's a new guy called Simon Conway Morris, actually crossed the ocean, the Irish Sea, to hear the guy last summer in Lancaster. And he's speaking about a kind of overall laws that might make sense of what he calls convergence, where you're definitely, for example, mammals and marsupials in totally different parts of the world, but similar niches, end up with similar solutions to the problem surviving. So the Darwinian theory is going through a lot of shaking ups, like any healthy theory is. And I suspect Darwin today, as you said earlier, John, David, he would be delighted with the genetics, but he'd be delighted, I suspect, with Evo Devo. He mightn't like Simon Conway Morris as much, I don't know. But in other words, there's a lot of questioning going on within biology, and it certainly isn't a rigid kind of area.
David, can I ask you about then the debate about creationism, intelligent design? We also had a text in from someone recommending the website Answers in Genesis, and saying that it's able to tongue-tie evolutionists and has fascinating things to say, and that, you know, we need a much more balanced discussion of evolution. What do you have to say to texts like that?
I think really this is a question of spin, and of the fact that scientists are generally very bad at communicating their ideas and what they do day to day.
what's happened in the United States particularly, which is where all of this opposition really is coming from, is that since the 1920s, there's been a rise in religious fundamentalism. And that then led to creationism coming in first. And then once creationism began to be properly dealt with in public debate, intelligent design has come in more recently. Intelligent design is essentially creationism without God, specifically named. There is an intelligent designer.
Well, we don't like to think we descended from monkeys.
But we didn't.
What did you say?
Evolution is saying that monkeys and humans, that the hominins as a group, descended from a common ancestor at some point in the past. One of the problems with the creationists and the intelligent design people is that they use very slick PR techniques and frank dishonesty to perpetuate their message. Many of the creationists, of course, are young Earth creationists, so they believe that the Earth is 6,000 years old. That causes them not just to go against modern biology, but against modern physics, modern geology, modern cosmology. That's relatively easily dealt with. The more pernicious end of it, in my personal view, is the view that says that all of the major elements of evidence for evolution that scientists use all the time are actually untrue. And there are some really pernicious books like Icons of Evolution that name and try to debunk elements of the evidence for evolution. And really, they just don't stand up to analysis. The problem, I think, is that very often people who debate against creationists or intelligent designers tend to be of the stripe of Richard Dawkins, who really have another political agenda. Rather than wanting to explain the science, they simply want to push perhaps an atheistic view in opposition to a theistic view.
And John, can I bring you in? Because Dan Hassett is continuing the fight for Alfred Wallace. He says that Wallace's papers were published 4 years before Darwin's, so you'll know who copied who. But I don't know if you want to comment on that again. But also, what about the Darwin and religion? If he wasn't an atheist, he certainly seems to have mixed views on religion.
Right. Well, on the Wallace thing, it's in the literature, and there's no need for me to repeat what is very well known here, and you can find it on Darwin Online. As for Darwin being an atheist, as we heard earlier, no, Darwin wasn't an atheist. As far as we know, he never was. When he was a young man, in my view, Darwin was never very religious. I don't think he really gave it much thought. He took for granted what he learned at church. He never thought that he needed to question the Bible, but he also was never very religious. And this he does mention a couple of times in his autobiography. The religious sentiment was never particularly developed in me. So he didn't really think about it that much. He didn't have particularly strong feelings. He goes in the Voyage of the Beagle. He's perfectly orthodox as far as he's concerned. But he is a man of science of his age. And we have to remember that the contemporary debates today about creationism, etc., they're not only scientifically wrong, but they're historically ignorant. The science of Darwin's day is a lot more sophisticated than that. Before Darwin goes in the Beagle, the last 200 years of science had already demonstrated the world was very old indeed. They didn't know how old it was, but they knew it was many millions of years because of all the geological strata, etc. The other thing that had been figured out by many scientists, and all of them were Orthodox Christians, was that there was a progressive series of fossil creatures in the rocks, which represented many eras of life before the present. And first you had shells, then fish, then reptiles, then extinct mammals, etc. And whenever anything disappeared, it never came back again. So that was accepted fact by all geologists except for one or two. So that's the state of the science when Darwin steps onto the scene. If you realize that these are the accepted facts of science in his day, and then you see that what he does is he creates the great synthesis of putting it all together and explaining it all in a way no one had yet achieved, then his science makes a lot more sense. It's today when we've forgotten these basic facts that were figured out before Darwin. If you're not aware that the fossil record represents this series, even in his early age of science, then of course it's possible to imagine that Darwin could be right or wrong, and that's what this is a debate about, or that there could be a debate about Darwin being right or wrong. That's not what it's all about. The science is so massive, even in Darwin's own day, that all of the scientific world was convinced. The fact that today we have mountains of evidence larger than anything the Victorians had means, as someone said earlier, I mean, there's just no debate anymore about this. It's unfortunate that many people still think that they need to oppose Darwin, or that they need to worry about the implications of Darwin's theory. But if you take a strict reading of Darwin himself, you don't have to worry about that. Darwin wasn't an atheist. As far as he was concerned, some intelligent thing had created the universe and had created the laws of nature by which nature functions. And a scientist, like himself, could discover these regularities and these laws by which nature functions. So for Darwin, he had found yet another law by which some intelligent designer had created the universe, which never interfered with it, as far as he was concerned. He was quite clear on that. But he discovered natural selection, which was the law by which creatures on the earth change over time.
Okay, well, we're almost out of time. So, Cyril, can I just go to you and say, well, what is his lasting legacy then? What is his great achievement? And how do you think he ranks along all the other scientists?
Oh, well, I'm no doubt myself, and lots of people would agree with me, I think, you have to rank Darwin alongside Newton. He is in that league. There is absolutely no question. And what Dobzhansky said about nothing in biology making sense except in the light of evolution, that really is the last word on the matter. His legacy is that we can understand how evolution took place. We couldn't understand before. And I'd like to make one point. Darwin, right at the very beginning, when he came back from the Beagle, opened a series of secret notebooks, and he drew a diagram of a tree. He didn't draw a ladder. He drew a tree. And what he's left us is this view of evolution, of different species of animals gradually differing, diverging over time. And there's no higher and lower in Darwin's theory. They are all equal, human beings, monkeys, whatever. They're not higher or lower, they're just different. And that provides the framework within which biology and natural history now proceed.
Okay, well, I'm going to leave it there. One of our liveliest debates and one of our best panels. I'd like to thank all my guests, Cyril Aidan, Father Brendan Purcell, David Croke, and John Van Wy. Darwin Online is an excellent resource on the web if people want to look at that.
Thanks for listening to a News Talk 106 to 108 podcast. To find out more, visit newstalk.ie.